Quest, episode 99.
99, it's a palindrome, and it's one away from 100. And it's also one away from 98.
We might just stop right here and just never do another episode.
No, what happened...
Just to be one short of 100.
Well, what's going to happen is we're going to actually do another podcast and cancel this one, but we'll call it He Said, He Said.
He said, he said. That's the dumbest name ever. I love that. He said, he said. If we don't do that, someone absolutely should do that.
Well, I was talking to a person I met online. It's like, yeah, we were talking about things in our personal lives and life in general and people. It's like, oh, we should do a podcast because we talk so much. It's like, why don't we call it He Said, She Said? It'd be very much on the whole Woody. It was a Woody Allen movie, wasn't it?
He Said, She Said?
Yeah, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, it's a real common.
But I remember it as the title of a movie. That's why it's so fresh in my head.
We do have the internet here.
Intranet.
We take you now to IMDb, because nothing is more fascinating in a podcast than listening to people surf the web.
And inaccurate. IMDb used to have me listed as another Roger Chang. They actually kind of combined the two different Roger Chang entries. And I was an actor that was born in 1947 that played the role of Phuc Thach Sing in Night Songs.
That's not you?
Well, I would have had to been 50 or something at the time I was.
It is a movie from 1991, but it's not a Woody Allen movie, apparently.
Oh, that's good.
It's a Kevin Bacon movie.
Oh.
And Sharon Stone.
That's it.
Directed by Ken Kwapis and Marissa Silver.
Marissa Silver.
It took two directors to make this movie.
Why? Was it that
I
bad? Oh, you know why? So each could direct their version of it. See, it was like He Said, She Said.
Then they
could
put out two director's cuts.
Oh, geez. You know what? It'd be funny if the comments were just kind of like a domestic squabble through the entire thing. No, I think you got it all wrong.
The commentary was just one.
Like the way people do with, you know, like when couples get together to show their vacation and they, you know, or some other social event that they were both at and they both have wildly disparate, you know, experiences or memories of that event.
Speaking of IMDb accuracy, the CNET TV show that's on G4 Tech TV Canada lists the cast as having Brian Cooley as herself.
Well, you know, Brian's a very common female name in Canada.
It's an easy mistake to make.
He is. Yeah, she is.
That's hilarious. I actually submitted Cooley's name for that show, but I'm pretty sure I didn't put herself down.
Hmm.
But I guess, I could make
maybe a correction. Maybe someone thought it was Bridget Cooley.
I could make a correction, but they make it so hard at IMDb to do anything.
Because you've got
to
pay money.
Not even that. I mean, yeah, you're right. You have to pay money for a bunch of stuff. But like making a correction is free, but you have to log in and then go to a special page and then, you know, enter your blood type. And I have to be in the mood to do that.
Oh, you got to be in the mood.
You know what I was doing earlier today? I was editing the Wikipedia article on Tech TV.
Why?
I don't know. It's just one of those. I was in the mood. I was curious after reading Russ Pitt's article that was on his blog about his time at Tech TV, what the entry was in Wikipedia, because I hadn't read it in a long time. It's actually pretty sparse. So I took Alex Albrecht out of the personalities. Not that I don't like Alex, but he never actually worked at Tech TV. He only worked at G4.
Well, you know, it's funny. No one's ever listed me, even though I was on both shows.
Well, what's funny is East Meets West is listed as a spinoff of Tech TV.
Which it clearly isn't.
Well, no. It says many former hosts of Tech TV programs have gone on to create new programs distributed online, and then East Meets West is listed. So... obviously, somebody knows that you used to work for Tech TV, and that I did as well.
No, under my Wikipedia entry, I'm listed. There's a link back to Tech TV, but they
don't have you as a show personality. Totally should be.
Even though I did call for help for like the last year,
maybe I'll just add you. Somebody added Sumi Das after I edited it. She wasn't in there either.
Well, the thing is, what's funny about Tech TV? If you look at it, you realize how much people really remember and left out, or like they didn't remember.
Yeah,
the audience members, because Tom and I have a very different viewpoint because we were actually in it. We were behind the scenes. We were producing all the content. So I'm not sure if it's disheartening to see that only certain faces get recognized.
True.
Like Kate Batella, was she?
Oh yeah, Kate's not listed here at all.
So that.
Oh
kind
yeah,
of,
yeah, she is. Oh, there okay. she is. No, she is listed here. Somebody put her in there. The other thing was they had somebody, whoever had written this article, had said that layoffs began in 1999, which is not true.
No.
There were not any layoffs in
1999. There were rumors of potential layoffs that year, at the end of that year.
So I put in beginning March 15th, 2001, Tech TV experienced repeated layoffs, because that's when the first website layoffs happened. And I even cited an article in support of that statement.
Russ's article?
No, no, the news.com article.
News.com. Oh, that's a little incestuous there.
So you did read the falsegravity.com. Have you finished reading it? It's rather long.
I didn't get to the, I think I'm on number 10 page.
Number 10 page.
Or
screen.
Well, you know, I don't want to necessarily get into it because I don't want to point out anything until someone's actually read it and go, and you know, there's some sort of groundwork or at least a reference context point. Is that wrong, or should I?
I'm sorry. What were you saying?
It's okay.
I was.
My girlfriend used to do that to me too.
No,
but that's why I'm single now.
You said you're only to page 10 of the 31 pages.
Yes.
Ah.
So I know it's interesting.
It gets even more interesting.
The reason why I say it's interesting is because although it starts with Tech TV when Tech TV was bought, the real story actually begins all the way back in the beginning of 98, which I was not there for.
Well, it actually begins even before that, if you can count the site.
You count the site. However, there were a lot of people that were brought in during that transition period that made ZDTV.
Well, you know, and this has got me – I think this is one of the reasons I was looking at the Wikipedia article. I was thinking, like, somebody should write a book about the whole Tech TV.
Yeah, I was going to – remember what I was going to do when I was going to do a tell-all, but from the viewpoint of this imaginary intern?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it should be a tell-all. Like expose,
fun, dude.
Well, a history with, I mean, the tell-all, okay, maybe I'm misinterpreting what you mean by tell-all. When I think of tell-all, I think of Kitty Kelly and bios where all they do is they go and they try to tell the dirtiest, most scandalous.
No, I would do that, but also, I would also put in, I would do the history, but I wouldn't like, I would do all the important facets.
Right.
I mean, the whole reason why we had sexual harassment training.
Yeah, I think an oral history would be good, where you get people to tell those stories.
But how can it be oral history if it's going to be written?
Well,
a joke.
Oh. You almost made me explain that to you. That would have been your punishment for that joke. But anyway, because I was talking with Allison Tome the other day, who I met first time. She used to be on The Money Machine. And
she's Asian, right?
She left ZDTV like a month before I started there. So we never had crossed paths.
And last time I heard, she was up in Seattle, but that could have changed. No, she was at CNN.
Was at CNN for a while. She's back now. She's doing TV in the Bay Area. But we were just talking about all the people we knew, you know, because they crossed over during our times. And so we're talking about the site and how, like, Ken Marcus, who was eventually the series producer of The Screensavers, was Richard's assistant at the site.
Yes.
And how Karsten Bondi, who is now, I think, still the series producer of X-Play?
No.
No? No longer?
He's no longer there.
Well, he was when X-Play went over to
G4. He was, but he was removed at the end of the year.
So, well, at the end of the first year?
I believe
so.
Oh, wow.
So he hasn't been a series producer for a while, then.
He might be doing some sort of series producing, but not for
G4. Huh. Anyway, Karsten was Dev Null.
Yes.
He was the
animator
of it.
He was the animator.
And then Leo
was
the
voice.
Yeah. You know, I think, wasn't Kate Batello a voice?
She did Dash.
I know she did the voice of Tilda at the beginning.
No, Tilda.
But Tilda wasn't on the site.
No, but she originally tried out to do one of the before she became the voice of Tilda. I think she tried out for the animatronic, no, not animatronic, but the motion capture portion of it where you wear the suit.
Oh, uh huh.
And then it was until later that I think Laura LeBlue came in and
because Kate was hosting the Screensavers and she was like, I can't be Tilda and host the Screensavers anymore. It's too much. So they had Laura LeBlue become the voice.
I think the real reason, though, is I think the other concern was they didn't want the same voice.
I think it was probably both.
It was like, you know, people's
a lot
like
of time, and they were like, actually, it's probably not a good idea to have the same voice
because it seems kind of odd for people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of events. There's a lot of important events that actually happened outside the office, so to
no,
speak.
Sure, yeah. Like, now, see, example, you're more interested in digging up the dirt.
It's not the dirt. I'm just saying,
the dirt is appropriate.
It is appropriate. It's how I got
sometimes
hired.
Sometimes it is.
It's how I got my job.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I'm not going to go into it right now, but
why
I'm telling
not?
You.
You're so interested in the dirt. You're
bringing
it up because
you're so gun-shy about it. I don't want to offend you in your domicile.
You're not going to offend me. You're probably just going to have a few friendships.
Fine, fine. I won't say
anything. Now everybody wants to know, of course.
Well, see, it makes him even more excited about the tell-all book when it comes out.
Oh, boy. See, that's not my point. My point isn't to, like, tell all. My point is to document the history and yeah, you're right. Some of it is,
but you need background history because on the characters because you wouldn't understand them as well otherwise.
Sure, I mean as you go along to tell the events.
I'm not
properly,
saying I'm not, again. I'm not doing straight as a tell. I'm gonna.
Yeah. You say that. You're just justifying it though. You totally want to just be a whistleblower.
Fine.
I can tell the big grin on your face right now. It's so true.
No, you know what I would do? I would write the history, and then I would do, like, you know, a little nugget between each chapter.
Just write the history. Actually, you know what? If you want a good taste of what we're talking about, though, go to falsegravity.com and read Tech TV Employee Number 1. Now, that's one thing I have an issue with, is Russ calls himself Tech TV Employee Number 1 because they made us wait. I hired him on the web originally before he went over to the TV side. They made us wait until the sale had gone through
to bring him on
because there was a hiring freeze during the sale. And that's just legal stuff. I mean, a lot of companies have to do that when there's a transaction. They can't put anything on or off the books for a short period of time. He makes it sound like, you know, they wanted to put out new letterhead with Tech TV on it or something. You know, he makes a joke out of it. And then he calls himself Tech TV Employee Number 1. It wasn't called Tech TV yet. It was actually called ZDTV still, after the sale.
The name change did not occur until well after.
Because the sale happened in what, like January?
It happened, the deal happened at the beginning of the year, but the name change didn't happen until
To August.
Yeah, until halfway through the year.
Yeah.
So,
It wasn't they needed to change letterhead.
No.
And I don't know if he's employee number one of the Vulcan Venture era or not. I'm sure there were other people brought on that same day. Yeah. Anyway, that is the least important fact about Russ's article. What I love about it is that it's just a real honest telling from his point of view of stuff that happened. And he's not with an axe to grind. Like, he calls himself on his own foibles as well and tells a lot of the pressures that went on and how I think he had one real good paragraph in there kind of summing up why we did what we did at the Screensavers. He does tend to make it sound like everything was perfect at the beginning and then it all fell apart at the end. And I don't see it quite that linear.
It was never that way. But that's the thing. And that's the only thing is you pointed out and rightly so that this is from his perspective when he started. Actually, having started my relationship with ZDTV a week as an intern before the network actually launched, I was quite familiar with a lot of the people, and I was also
design intern, right?
No, I that's the thing. Originally, I applied as a web intern for Lucia.
Lucia Caracci.
Lucia was really like on a roll, not on a roll, but she was on a rampage to get like the site up. And so she had a very dismissive attitude, like, you know, if you can't cut it, don't even think about it. It's like, all right. And it's like, and I was talking to Ali Hosseini was there and they were both interviewing me and they're going back and she's basically telling me why I don't want the job, like, or the internship. And then Ken Marcus at the time this is when they had very few offices and they're all on one floor. Ken Marcus is next and he was eavesdropping. He's like, hey, well, you want an internship? We're looking for a PA for the show. It's like, oh, are you interested? He's like, yeah, it'd be awesome. So I started out as a PA for both Call for Help and Screensavers. So at that time, it was kind of weird because
You were working there already beforehand, right?
No.
No?
You
applied for an internship, but you didn't get it. You started as the PA.
No, I started as an intern.
You started as an intern for Call for Help Screensavers.
Yes, exactly. I didn't get my web internship.
Where did I get the graphics from then? I don't know where I got that from.
No, I was originally a graphic arts major.
Oh, that's why.
In college.
Okay. All right.
But I did that, and then I moved on to after my 3 months, I did a lot of the work that the PA was supposed to be doing at the time. I was working with Kate Olson. And it was a generally a very exciting time. A lot of people were really excited. I mean, we jokingly refer to the three head guys: the head of finance, the head of programming, and the head of actual production, as the three tall men, because they were all
the
like
tall white guys.
The tall white guys.
Yeah.
Well, they called them the three tall men because they were exactly
like the
almost
wise
the same
men,
height.
Yeah.
The three exactly almost right. the same height, and they went around in a group and they went to each department and they're talking. And I remember like shuttling back and forth between the studio and the office, getting products, going to Grace, talking to Carrie Hall at the time, getting products from her and dropping back. Over so I knew all that I knew when they did the Devo, which I wasn't invited to during the original launch party. I did get in on the ramp edition of the DirecTV launch party, which was kind of cool. A lot of cool stuff. I learned a lot. I was really, really kind of overwhelmed because I was like, oh, my God, I'm in the middle of this huge network launch thing that I've never done before. I was like 23. So all that whole thing just kind of like totally overwhelmed me. And it wasn't until I started as a PA that I started learning about the backstories between everyone, the relationships between everyone, because I started working with them more intimately. When I was an intern, I saw Leo, but I didn't really work with him. I saw Kate, and I didn't really work with her. I just, I gave him stuff, and I brought stuff back. It wasn't until I was a PA I actually started talking to them on a regular basis. And, the first time I met with Leo, I was kind of not scared, but I was
nervous.
Yeah, nervous. Not technically in awe, but I was like, hey, he's the head of the show. You don't want to, do anything wrong. And he points his finger to the door, you're out. So I kind of had that very kind of timid attitude. But it was until I started working with a lot of people, I got to know them better. Another thing that I think because Russ came in later is because a lot of us, myself included, actually all worked at the same or came from the same school. We all went to a lot of the production people and a lot of the studio people.
Such a bore.
Huh?
Everybody talks. Oh yeah, I went to SF State with him. I went to SF State with him. So what? It's as bad. Let me tell you. It's exactly as bad as we are now when we're at our jobs going, oh, yeah, I worked with Tech TV with him. Oh, yeah,
Tech TV. Well, it's funny because
it's the
like,
looks that I get from people when I say
that. Well, it's funny because you only remember these people back in class. And then it's like, oh, wow, you're working here and I'm working with you. It's like, yeah, it's like college.
Yeah, but I mean, getting back to Russ's thing, though, I think even though he sort of tells it in this classical narrative where like everything is good and then things fall apart and there's a conclusion. It's a well-told story in that respect. I don't think it was quite that linear. And I think the issues that he addresses as being the conflict and the sources of conflict were always the issues. And I think he's right that
you mean always the issues from the beginning, even
from the
before.
Beginning.
Okay.
At least from my impression, those issues were there when I got there in 99, and they had been there for a while, and they continued until the very final day. And there is sort of the issues that he brings up are the idea of serving the geek audience versus serving the mainstream audience, and what kind of programming you put on there, watering it down by doing celebrity stuff, and whether you're, how many calls you take and all of that. And I don't think it's as simple as, like, it was so great at one point and then it all changed.
No, I totally agree with that.
But I
like,
do think
your,
probably
your assessment.
Over time, you can easily admit that the weight went away from the geek.
Yeah.
And it kind of went in ups and downs.
Well, it was, as I was about to say, it was a very roller coaster kind of affair. And the thing is, I was there in the meetings right after it became Tech TV, and we actually all sat down. People don't really understand, and Tom is well aware of this, how small those production groups were. I was an associate producer. Dan was the other associate producer. There was only two of us. We had one PA, and we had one line producer. We had Kate and Leo. That was it for producing the TV content. So that we had to book guests.
Yeah, there was no series producer.
Oh, no.
There was a producer.
There was a series producer at one point capacity, Renee Arricchio, but she left, and they never really got a replacement.
Before I got there, Renee.
And the thing was, you were saying those issues. And those issues kind of morphed over time. They weren't static issues. They were ones that changed depending on the demand. Originally, we had issues with sales, not being able to sell the ad spots in between the shows. Like for a one-time call for help was beating Screensavers regularly in the ratings.
And then when that was before we had ratings. That's before we had real ratings, anyway.
Right? Initially, no. I think it was. When did the actual Nielsen?
Arbitrons until like 2003, I think.
Okay, okay. In that case, yeah. But I remember like there were the ad buys for screens and stuff. Like when we first started, there were a lot of people were kind of indignant. It's like we're running a Rotato ad in our block.
The Rotato ad.
But I remember when we were in the meeting. We were trying to differentiate between Call for Help and Screensavers.
Tools and toys.
Yeah. Well, Call for Help was the technology show for people who wanted to use technology as a tool, be it the home office, education, things like that, of that nature. Well, Screensavers was more of the geekier side, definitely where the technology was a toy. It's like cool things you could do with it. And one of my suggestions I made when Paul just started at that point was
Paul Block, executive producer.
Was to take Screensavers and move it away from just doing, you know, technology help and make it into the, you know, kind of the geek nerd show, mm-hmm. where you encompassed a lot of things that would appeal to that audience.
And he tried to do that, but the problem was he didn't really understand
exactly
the way you understood that concept. And so he tried to make it a variety show.
He based it on his experiences.
Exactly. And good experiences in many respects.
In some cases, yes.
But not geek experiences. And
no.
So there was this constant tension over, and the reason I'm bringing this up is I think it's still a tension with CNET and Ziff Davis and Revision 3 and all of these companies, which is where do you target? Who do you shoot your stuff for? Because what we found that nobody really liked was the geekier the better.
Yes.
And, you know, talking about networking and Windows tips and Linux was the popular stuff. And I think the reason for that is you demonstrated through your enthusiasm, because the people who were doing this content really loved it, that you understood. And I think that was where Russ had a really good paragraph where he's like, we were doing this because we liked it and it showed and people watched it because they said, damn, these are people like me.
Exactly. And to kind of layer upon that is that we did something at the time that no other show did on a regular basis, and that was include our audience as an active part of the show.
Yeah, I mean, way ahead.
People aren't even
doing some of the stuff we did yet.
No,
they're just talking about it.
And we were doing like the webcam.
The Netcam network. Exactly,
the Netcam work. We worked so hard in the initial year to generate, to cultivate, to solicit all those net cameras, to build up our regulars, to build up a kind of a running understanding of how that system worked. People would call, and if they had a net cam connection, you know, on a high-speed internet connection, we would use them. We'd get their audio by phone, so we would always have that. But having that audience interaction, having that kind of face-to-face, even for people who didn't get on, they could vicariously feel like, hey, I'm part of that show. I'm part of that audience. I'm no longer just a one-directional recipient. I can contribute as well. When we had a question we couldn't answer, Leo would say, okay, we send it to you, to the audience. Send us an email. Give us a call. If you know the answer to this, let us know. And that empowered a lot of people because now it's like, hey, they're not just people like me. They want me, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want to think that
they're not just talking down to me.
Exactly. They're not patronizing. They're not condescending. They're actively soliciting my help, my information, my experience into all this. And it was like, oh, wow, now I'm part of a community that encompasses technology, encompasses the internet, encompasses television. And I think for a lot of people, you know, for where we were broadcasting, it was like, oh, wow, I've never seen this before. This is really cool. In the same way MySpace, a lot of social networking sites work, connecting people who aren't directly related or but mm-hmm. do have similar tastes.
Well, I think Twitter is feeding off of some of that as well.
But just having that, and it was just amazing at the time. But the thing, when we originally started, we were like, is this thing going to even take off? We get the same five people all the time. Not that those five people were bad, but we were worried that...
Well, yeah, because you have to take a while. It takes a while to build your
audience. But we were worried that people would think, oh, they only have those certain five people on all the time. You know what I mean?
I run into this at CNET all the time. You overthink yourself in these situations. We're like, oh, well, if we only have five people, then people will think this. Or if we only take these kind of questions, then we'll only get these kind of. And it's like, you know what? Just freaking do it for a while
yeah.
before you make any of those
But assumptions. At the same time, there was a lot of money riding and being invested in that infrastructure. I mean, we spent a lot to get those machines,
yeah.
that patch working. Even in the Tech TV, we were having audio patch issues. We're having video patch issues. I mean, most of that was mitigated at that point, and we had a tome. We had a running knowledge of how everything was supposed to work. You know, I had people who called the show still remember me because I answered the phones a lot. And to do it, it was just kind of fun. It was kind of neat to see, not themselves only on TV, but to see other people like, hey, that's your room. I can see that little sign.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
my hair.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I think that was really cool. Ahead of its time.
Well, and one of the things we just did on Buzz Out Loud is we had a listener co-host episode where
oh, nice.
We actually called listeners and just put them on and recorded the conversation and talked to them for about 10 minutes or so. And when you have really smart people –
yep.
When you cultivate that and you have
exactly.
really smart people in your audience, you can do that because they have something to say.
But I think that's where you manage the expectations. If you say, you know, if you continually show people that are articulate or smart but are still geeky at the same time, people say, hey, you know, I'm on this. It's not going to be like Howard Stern. I get to mouth off
rip
into people. It's going to be an intelligent conversation about technology, about gadgets, about social, legal issues pertaining to people who enjoy this kind of this pastime.
That's why everybody always wants us to do Talk Show for East Meets West, and I frankly am just too lazy. That's the only reason we haven't done it.
That and it's just yeah. It, the reason why this show's been on as long as it has is because it's bare bones,
yeah.
and we can do it anywhere, literally.
Well, and we should take some of the comments off the
yes.
blog at subbrilliant.com/EMW. Jay Ash is back.
Yes. Where
he
did
says,
he go?
What sucks more than a 256K internet connection? Answer, nothing. Anyway, I'm back.
Where is he at? Where he gets
well, I think he's in India.
Oh.
As I recall,
I thought Jay Ash was
in
Jay Ash in Singapore?
I thought he was in Mumbai.
Huh. I'm sorry if I got your location incorrect.
Anyway, he asks who's doing the album art these days. Nobody's been doing album art in a while. We do not require you to do album art. But we love it when people do it.
It adds to the community feel.
Definitely. Punter Joe says, Jay Ash, it's too bad there's no tool to do for podcasts what Opera Mini does for web pages, digest it and turn it into something super lean. You know, it's just the...
Isn't that like George Foreman's grill?
Actually, if you go to archive.org, they make several different versions of East Meets West when I upload it. I only link to the variable bitrate one, but you can find the others.
I mean, do you save it as a variable bitrate? MP3?
I just put it up as a 96K MP3, and then Archive does its magic to
okay.
it.
But it's a mono audio.
Yeah, it is mono.
Okay.
Tom and Roger, Punter Joe says, it was fun to hear you and V reminisce about your PCs back in the day. I remember I had to wheedle and beg to get a hand-me-down IBM XT at work, which since it wouldn't run Windows, I threw GeoWorks Ensemble on.
You know what? I still have that at home in a
GeoWorks
box.
GeoWorks Ensemble?
Yeah, I bought it back when Windows started taking off, and it was on sale for like $12.
Uh-huh.
So I picked up and installed my dad's machine. It is one of the best DOS-era GUI interfaces ever made.
This was in the heady days before IT managers trickled down to small businesses. I was also able to slip in a fax modem card. The company was unaware of fax at the time and used to have people transcribe documents over the phone. I missed the days when companies permitted, if not actually encouraged, employees to think outside the box, if only because they were less concerned with process than result. Good times. Still, there was no intraweb, no podcast blog, smartphones, or any of the other modern necessities. What do you think will be the next big thing we won't be able to imagine life before? By the way, it doesn't have to be tech. It could be medical, new energy source, or earth-shaking philosophy, like proof that we're all Sims or the ant farm of some advanced alien kid. Any category that will fundamentally change everything. Any ideas?
I would say at some point having instantaneous access information to someone no matter where they are. They tried to do this a while ago, but imagine if you had one identifying code, whether it's an email.
I was just thinking about that the other day.
Yeah, one identifying code, whether it's an email, phone number, or instant message, always direct gets to you no matter where you are.
I was thinking of that because I went to take my car into the shop.
Uh-huh.
And we had a problem with them before where they called our number, but the shop is actually in a different area code than I am. So like they called the wrong area code, and we never got the call when our car was ready. And there was a big miscommunication. Anyway, so this time I said, do you have the right number? And they said, yep, this one here. I saw 415, which is my cell phone area code, San Francisco. I was like, great, no problem. It was my wife's phone. It was my wife's cell phone number. So then 20 minutes after they called her cell phone and left a message – she calls me and was like, hey, the car company called me. And I was like, you know, I should have looked and looked at the rest of the number. But wouldn't it be nice if you could just say, if they just knew, like, Tom Merritt, and I had some identifier number, because there's a bunch of Tom Merritts.
Well,
right?
Yeah, so but
Tom Merritt 022. And all you had to say was, are you Tom, what's your identifier number? I'm Tom Merritt 022. Great. Now we know how to contact
you. Well, that'd be perfect. And then I think the other thing is compositing information from disparate sources. You see that now with Google Maps, where you can overlay location information, mm-hmm. but not just location. For example, you could do bars, you could do theaters, do traffic.
Taxis.
And, you know, it'd be kind of, yeah, exactly.
Rentals.
So once you have all that and you can condense it, and I think the key, not so much anymore, is culling new information, but rather taking all the information you have and assembling it in a way that makes it useful. I think that will be the kind of big thing. That or we all move back to donkey carts when we run out of gas.
Yeah, well, there is also the coming apocalypse when the virus finally hits and we all die.
Depending only for those who have no immunity.
SoCal Jess says, show highlight. Veronica's in the house.
Oh, how come always people say Veronica? It's a show highlight, but when Roger Tom, it's like, it's just Roger Tom.
Because we're
Tom.
Here every week. Can't be a highlight every week, can it?
I don't know. Let's try.
Show low light. Discussion on collective bargaining died out a bit when Tom went micless.
What do you mean? Tom had the mic.
Roger bullied me off the mic.
Oh, you held it. How could I bully it? Oh.
Tom and Roger Chang, what are your New Year's resolutions for 2008?
Get a steady girlfriend.
Not work so damn hard. Relax. I'm going
to
kick back.
Actually, no, that and actually have a lot of fun to do a lot of cool stuff.
John in Connecticut says, regarding hidden images in audio, Venetian Snares hid an image of his cats in the song Look off the album Songs About My Cats, and the guy from Aphex Twin put a picture of himself into one of his tracks. You have to use a spectrogram to look at the audio. See the images here at bastwood.com/aphex.php. That's APHEX, by the way. Also, you may have read that Pete Jackson is coming back to the producer for the new Hobbit movies.
That's good.
Yeah, they're going to do two.
Well, that spectrogram is really kind of weird looking.
Oh, are you looking at?
Yeah.
Let me open it up here. I didn't click.
It just, I hate to say it, it kind of looks like a sonogram or ultrasound.
Well, that would make sense.
No, but I was thinking like when he was, when I read that comment, for some reason I was thinking like the way you can do, where you can insert an image into an audio file. And then
is actually in the audio, not just in the file, like an ID3 tag or something. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You can just put images in the ID3 tags, but that's not the same. So what do you think? Hobbit, good? Pete Jackson producing?
Yes.
He's not necessarily going to direct, though.
Well, so. if he has a controlling...
personality?
if he has a majority control over the scope and direction, I think that could be good. Ah. Then again, you know, I liked King Kong, but I didn't think it was as interesting as I thought it would be.
We just watched King Kong this past week.
Oh, did you get the HDVD?
Yeah, I got the Xbox 360.
And you got on discount, didn't you? And there was a stack.
Well, King Kong was actually in the box.
No, I know, but the drive itself was the 10% discount.
Yeah, I got it at CompUSA.
See, isn't HDVD cool?
I have to admit, it looked really good.
Once you connect it to the web, does your Xbox connect it online?
Yeah.
There's like the Transformers DVD. HDVD, there's additional stuff you can pull off the web.
Yeah. Well, I already ordered I sent out my order for 5 free HD DVDs this morning, too, because you get that free deal.
I never got a receipt from Amazon, so I kind of passed on it.
Oh, really?
Kind of pissed me off, but whatever.
See, I had a receipt from CompUSA. Now, I'm wondering if they see the discount. Are they going to, like, say,
no.
Oh, you're disqualified?
The whole point is to basically get more people watching HDVD so the format can have a broader space.
But it looked good.
Oh, it's awesome.
I mean, I was impressed. I had seen high def before. And I mean, high def DVDs and Blu-ray DVDs and stuff at shows or in stores. And I was like, yeah, it looks good, but I don't know. It doesn't look that much better. But then when you're actually in your own house looking at it, it's like, wow, this really does look
better. What I like about HDVD is the dual tuners. So you can have picture-in-picture through the Xbox.
Right.
And I'll have the commentary. I'll have like a director or special effects commentary in the lower right picture talking about that particular scene. That stuff it's amazing. If you get Heroes, the box, I'm not sure if you're a big fan of Heroes. If you get that, there's some amazing extras on the HDVD that once you start using, you're going to flip.
John in Connecticut also points to a Wikimedia
picture,
bigger image of a Venetian snare song. Jeremy says, the podcast in my iTunes feed ended at 4:16. Hope anybody else didn't have that problem. He was the only one I heard. Occasionally I think servers just crap out.
You have
to re-download.
Or your ISP might do something.
Right. Joypog says, bummer, I was hoping Tom would go into the whole roids and baseball thing.
Oh, that's right.
Bunch. But I did like the debate over the writers. My thoughts, a bunch of professionals who get paid really well bitching about not getting paid even more fabulously better while screwing up their bosses' schedules and costing a bunch of working folks their jobs. As for PEDs, I'm so happy that Bonds isn't the only guy who gets talked about now. Woohoo. I think that's the performance enhancing.
Okay, got it.
Let's take the fabulously well paid really well bitching about how they don't get paid even more fabulously well. Dave Broadbeck says, on the writer's strike, even if they are well paid, and I know some folks that do that work that are not super rich, believe me, they still deserve to get their share of interweb royalties. I've been on strike 3 times, once as a professor, twice as a TA. I can say that strikes are no fun. Feeding a family of 4 on $325 a week in strike pay is no fun. Though in the prof strike at Memorial University of Newfoundland in 2000, we did play road hockey on the picket line. We are Canadian, after all. Academic strikes are odd. We are so civilized, the administration guys would come out and bring us donuts. I can say that I swore off donuts for like 4 years after those 13 days.
It's interesting. I mean, it depends on... I can honestly say that it depends on the situation. For example, for some individuals, and we mentioned this in the last show, whose professions hinge on whether or not production begins, because they're either studio crew, they do the garments for...
Yeah, but they're not on strike. They're just in the...
Exactly, but their jobs, they're not working.
Right.
So they, from their point of view, they see
that has nothing to do with her point, though. I mean, or his point, Joypog's point, which is writers going on strike, and they already get paid a lot, and they're just whiny. And you hear the same argument when
my point is point of view, and that was my point, is like, mm-hmm. his point of view is that these people are getting paid a lot to essentially write, you know, content for TV, and, you know, they're basically bitching about nothing. For some people, you know, it's a matter of, like, if you take the company side, well, look, you know, if you keep doing this, we're going to force production out here. We can't, you know, make our ends meet, and we need to get royalties because so much of our money is being lost through piracy and other, you know, alternative avenues where we're not getting paid directly. I'm saying there's also a third group of people who are hinging on whether or not these people go back to work because...
Sure, yeah, and they're going to get screwed either way, right?
And that my thing is you can't cut them out entirely because all these feed on each other. All these people have a stake. So whether or not, you know, it's the union's fault, whether or not it's the big company...
Yeah, what are you trying to say?
Oh, no, that all this depends on whether or not you consider it fair or not. It depends on your point of view.
Well, I think it's too easy to say, well, they already get paid well enough.
But that's,
here's the thing, right? If you're in a business, you're working really hard.
Yep.
You're trying to make your company strong.
Yes.
And the CEO comes out and says, congratulations, everyone. We have tripled our revenues this past year because of all your hard work.
Yes.
Thank you very much. And you're like, okay, well, what does that mean? And then it comes raise time, and they're like, 4%, just like every year. You're going to feel screwed? Of course. You may be making enough money to get by.
Yeah, I know. But
Dango feels upset.
But I think you prove my point. It's your point of view that, you know, I'm not saying – I'm not.
So what I'm saying is it's too easy to just say, well, you already make enough money. It's not – it's all relative.
But that's my –
It has to do with whether – you are getting fairly compensated for what they're making off of you.
I mean, if we're talking about like one like high level manager, you know, let's say like a group of high level managers at a large insurance company all go and try it because they don't make the same amount as another group of high level managers in a different department, even though they roughly do the same thing. I mean, for the people down at the bottom, all these people make 10 times more than they do. For them, they see it's like a bunch of rich people yelling at each other who get – do you see my point? I think you hit on it when you said it's all relative. It depends on your point of view.
Well, it has to do with like you are – I am providing a service that makes you X amount of money.
Yes.
Therefore, my service is worth a percentage of that. And if you start making more money off that, my service is more valuable and I should be compensated more.
That's your point.
I think it's a side point and a good point about the fact that in this battle between the owners and
the writers,
the producers and the writers, the people who really get shafted are the grips.
Yeah,
and
well,
the camera folks,
and that's
you know,
and ultimately
the
PAs and. That's the perception for the people at the bottom. It's like, we got screwed by people who make a lot of money, and we didn't get anything in the end. In fact, we lost. We lost our livelihoods. We lost ability.
Well, I think that's going too far.
Well, you don't
they
know.
Will go back to work eventually.
Eventually, maybe. But you cannot ignore that they have taken an economic impact. They've taken a hit, and you can't really dismiss that and say, well, yeah, they're going to go back to work. I mean...
I'm not dismissing it. Just saying to say they all lose their livelihoods is
well, no, but I'm just kind of doing for their from their perspective. Maybe they might, depending on what their jobs are.
Finally, Ben says, I'm looking at Dig right now after spending the day free of computer or television stimuli, and I see the story Lakota Indians withdraw treaties signed with U.S. 150 years ago.
I saw that.
Yikes. Boiling Point is indeed fantastic. One of the premises in Boiling Point is that the Lakota Nation secedes from the United States. Now, for mostly reasons of simplicity, I have them taking North and South Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And the reason being, like, they just basically take over the state governments there. But in actuality, they have more of western South Dakota, parts of Wyoming, Montana.
It's
and
five
small,
states.
Small
if you look at
Dakota,
if you look at the five states in that area, it's kind of an amorphous collection, but kind of a drawn line.
And this is really interesting because they have been proceeding down this road. This isn't something where they just all, you know, recently got up and said, "Ah, we're independent of the U.S. We're going to forget the treaties." They have been going down this road since the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
They have been preparing. They've got their ducks in a row.
Yep.
And they are ready to go before the UN and say, you know what? This treaty was not honored. The treaties that we signed 150 years ago, therefore it's worthless. Therefore, we're seceding. I mean, not even seceding. They're basically dissolving their tie with the United States.
Which presents an interesting political aspect to everything, right? I mean, you can go before the UN and say that, but the UN has no power beyond whatever.
To compel the United States.
Compel
to
do anything, right?
Yeah. Because, but then what does the United States do, right?
Well, see, that's...
this is what they've done that's very smart, is they have collected their evidence, they've gone through proper channels, they've gained support, and now they have basically made a very bold move, and the way the United States reacts is going to be very telling. I mean, if the United States ignores it, it's probably the best thing because they can continue to build momentum. If the United States reacts, then it brings it to a head, and it could actually get very difficult.
It depends. I mean, you know, like I said, it has a very interesting political implication. How do you decide who of those in that Lakota Nation is part of that nation?
Well, actually, I think that's the less part of it because there already is a procedure for recognizing who are the tribal leaders and who are running the reservation and what the borders are and everything.
But that's
all agreed on.
Well, I know that's, but I mean, like, if you take it further, I mean, how can someone say, well, you know, my grandfather?
It doesn't matter, though, because they're saying anybody who lives in our lands can stay there as long as they renounce U.S. citizenship.
We're
fine with that.
Uh-huh.
So they've gotten around that, like, you have to prove you're Lakota or whatever. I mean, as far as the negotiating powers, though, the people that are leaders are recognized
by the United States
as the tribal leaders.
I don't
have to get into who's Lakota and who's not.
That's true, but no, I'm saying is for those people. Well, for example,
it's all about leaders and territory.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, who if all those people get to stay and they renounce U.S. citizenship, can they then affect their own government? Those people who are not Lakota, can they go into the tribal meeting and say, yeah, we want this or
well,
we
that's
want
up
that.
To the Lakota.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, then you have people. I mean, I think it's going to get a lot stickier for both sides than they realize. Now the thing is, from what I understand, there's roughly 30,000 people. Within that tribe that are behind this. Now, it would also and this is where I think internationally it gets sticky because there's a lot of countries with similar issues.
Yeah.
There's a lot of countries in South America, in Africa, in East Asia, South Asia, Australia.
Yeah, this is a problem that Americans often think of as over there. Like, it's a problem in Yugoslavia or it's a problem in East Timor. It's a problem in Africa.
But see, that's the thing is the Balkans is a classic example.
Yeah.
Currently, you know, is it Kosovo that wants to break apart and be independent?
Right.
However, for the EU, that presents kind of a sticky situation.
True.
Because if they did that, then what's to stop them, for example, from the Flemish saying, okay, we don't want to be part of
Basques.
Of Belgium. Exactly,
the Basques. Catalans.
I mean, you already kind of have, and this is really more of a British thing, the devolution of a rule to the local.
Welsh and Scotland. Yeah.
Welsh, Scotland. Yeah. But who's to say that any group or minority or peoples within them can't say the same thing?
Well, the whole problem with Northern Ireland, frankly, is not just about UK imperialism, but the problem with Northern Ireland is that a large amount of people who live in Northern Ireland are Scottish or English.
Yeah.
That were they brought over and colonized hundreds of years ago in an effort to kind of tilt the population away from the Irish.
I mean, to say, and that's what I think they're using this as a really bold gambit, but to say that suddenly by bringing forward the UN, they'll all those parties, like...
Yeah, I'm just saying.
I know.
The UN is obviously not even the strongest lever in their... But they have done it in a way where the UN will hear them. It's
But honestly, I think
high profile.
It might be high profile, but you can say that for any instance where this occurs. Again,
you know what I'm saying is in other words, they are on the level with East Timor and Kosovo.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the UN is the solution to their problems, but it isn't like just a bunch of guys got together and said, we're independent, and everybody's like, no, you're not. I mean, an analog would be the Texas Republic movement.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a bunch of people who say Texas was not properly annexed by the United States, and therefore it's independent, and we've petitioned the UN. No one really takes them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really haven't followed proper channels, and maybe they have a point. Apparently there was not a quorum in Congress when the annexation happened, but they haven't got the weight of a real organized legal
the closest,
representation,
I mean, but,
legal standing.
Yeah.
However, have just as much standing as any other
minority. I think you're onto something. I think you're absolutely correct. At the same time, that hasn't really, you know, you see the same thing in Canada where you have the, you know, Quebec
as
trying
far
to.
As you, like, will it eventually be successful or not is what you're
saying. Whether
or
not, but see, that's the thing. Whether or not, and that's the thing. The other thing is, I mean, from a symbolic standpoint, this is really huge. This is really a bold move. Practical standpoint, however, is a different matter entirely. You're landlocked. I mean, if you take it to kind of a really kind of a nuanced view, if you're landlocked nation with no trading ties with any other country, you're going to have to pay overflight rights. You're going to have to pay. You know what I mean? There's a lot of practical things.
Of course. But look at Eritrea. You know, they took the coastline away from Ethiopia.
Yeah,
and nobody thought that was going to ever happen
because
who? Why would Ethiopia allow themselves to become landlocked?
Yeah,
but they eventually worked it out.
Wait!
There's plenty of other examples
of indigenous people
that have not won their rights back.
I think it's disingenuous to say that whole issue between Ethiopia and Eritrea has been kind of solved because
it's not that there still isn't tension, but they actually separated, and a lot of people thought that would never happen.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, you realistically for those people inside, on one hand, you have an area, for example, Ethiopian ears. It's in a hotbed of a lot of tension that's always existed, and also a lot of violence. I mean, they've never been really a strong central government that allowed.
Ethiopia's got a fairly strong central government. Ethiopia is actually a very stable country.
They strong in the sense of having enough of a military to force people, but doesn't mean it's not a restless country. I disagree on your point that it's a stable.
But I still don't see what the difference is. I mean,
well, no, but I'm. T-
I, I'm just. I'm yeah. just as
I'm
an
trying,
example.
Yeah.
I'm trying to say there are examples of things in
no, but
that have happened that you wouldn't have thought would happen.
That's true, but
are landlocked and all of that.
However, if I'm allowed to continue,
no.
Okay.
I'm stopping the podcast.
That's fine. That's your prerogative.
Right.
Well, no, my thing is for those people at that point, you know, at what point do you get diminishing returns? What point do you say, okay, now we're independent. Oh, well, what I'm going to do in terms of...
Yeah, you're thinking farther ahead than I am. I'm just still fascinated that they have done it in a way that will cause people to seriously discuss it.
Yep.
Which I think lots of other Indian nations have tried to do this. Hawaii has won autonomy, but... It's almost meaningless.
But see, that's the same thing there for a lot of people, you know, who aren't in the thing, you know, for a lot of people who live in Hawaii who are either mixed or non-Hawaiian, it's like, okay, so what does that mean for us? And for some of the Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians. It's like, okay.
It is very symbolic.
It's symbolic, and that's the point.
Yeah. Do you think that's what will happen with the Lakota?
It might be
end up with some sort of autonomy arrangement like Hawaii.
I think people don't realize a lot of native areas, for example, the Navajo, are treated as a separate nation. That's where you can have the gambling casinos and stuff, not subject to state law. It really depends because I don't think
the Lakota. And I'm just guessing here. I have no idea. But I don't think the Lakota truly want to be an independent nation so much as they want to be taken seriously and renegotiate their relationship with the United States.
I think in the end what's going to happen, and this is my personal view, opinion, is that there's going to be some sort of monetary settlement with a continuing trust that's being paid for into by the U.S. Federal government on an annual basis. So that means there's going to be essentially a large cash –
I don't know that they would settle for that, though. I think what they want is a new legal arrangement, a newly negotiated.
Plus, certain areas will be considered their territory.
Well, that's already true.
Yeah, but I mean, like you were saying, with new legal arrangements, I mean, certain things would only apply there would be treated as a.
I think what they want is a better deal. Basically, they have their own territory.
Yeah,
they have a tribal government.
But what is your better deal? I mean, it's kind of a vague.
A lot of it has to do with cash.
That's what I'm saying.
But,
so,
but a lot of it also has to do with rights and treatment.
But that's what
services
like
that they don't get.
But that's what I'm saying. So
it's not all just money. It's also
How are you going to pay for those services?
You need the money to pay for the services. Exactly. But getting a bunch of cash doesn't give you services necessarily.
That's true. But you can't pay for those services.
And we're both right.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But that's what I'm saying. In the end, you want the resources, which in this day and age is essentially money.
No, but getting just cash doesn't get you the right to buy the service from the United States government. They need both.
But see, that's what
you can't get the services.
What service are you referring to?
Well, any kind of better highway administration or medical
if they're treated as a separate nation, is that they can set up all them. They would have that autonomy.
Yeah, but what they want is they want experts, and they can hire them.
What do you mean they can't? If they gave them the money, you cannot. And you were – let me put it this way. If you're given a trust fund with
– Okay, hold, let me let's wait, put, wait. It, put it this other way. If the United States government has services that you could take advantage of, does the United States not have services that you can't get anywhere else?
Like highways? I don't think the federal highways that pass.
You don't think it would make it easier to get services into a country to have the cooperation of the government and the ability to say, look, we'll pay for it ourselves. We'll fund it.
Uh-huh.
We just need the EPA or we need the USGS or we need, you know. We need
couldn't you hire a group of environmental scientists?
Maybe.
Because it would be your own property. I mean, I don't understand. If they have control over their own territory...
Granted, there are a lot of things you could hire out, but then there's a lot of things you could get from the government.
It's the same thing. The government's going to be paying for them anyway.
It's not as simple as cash. That's all I'm saying.
I know it's, but to have that money there,
arguing as if I'm saying they shouldn't get any money, and I'm not.
No,
I'm saying they need a lot of money. I'm just saying that's not the only
thing they need.
Because, you know what? The U.S. government would like to do is dump a bunch of cash on them and then leave. And that is not going to do any good.
That doesn't matter what.
That's what they've been doing for years. It's like, we'll throw some money at you. And,
no, that's the problem. They haven't been. That's
no
why
aid.
A lot of these places are impoverished.
Not enough. Yeah.
But that's what I'm. That's my point.
But you need more than just dumping money.
But that's the thing is if they have the ability, the right to kind of.
You think just giving them a bunch of money would be that? That's it. That would solve all their problems.
No, I'm not talking about solving the problem. I'm talking about the resolution of this particular issue. For the Lakotas, hey, listen, give me the money, and we'll get together. We'll form a government. We'll form a group
that they already have a government.
So I mean, so they can then develop their particular resource. They
can
develop.
You don't think they'll need any aid from the U.S. government in any of those after the money?
All this aid has to be paid for, so it comes down to money anyway. You can't hire a group.
If I'm
a group of
foreign. If I'm a foreign country,
uh huh.
there's a lot of real restrictions on what kind of expertise of the U.S. I can use. If I'm a state or an autonomous unit within the country, I can take advantage of a whole lot more expertise than I can otherwise. And I'm talking about research and science. And
that all boils down to money, because that's how much the government... Yes, it does!
How does it boil down to money? The U.K. is extremely rich, but they don't get to take advantage of the things that the state of Ohio does. And it has nothing to do with money. It has to do with the fact that Ohio is a state in the United States.
So what you're saying is the Lakota, the way to solve this is to make the Lakota territories a state of the United States.
The way to solve this is I'm not even freaking disagreeing with you.
I know, but I think
you're just it sounds to me like you're saying you just dump a bunch of cash and say goodbye, and that won't work.
I'm not saying you're dumping your cash pretty much in perpetuity.
And that works. That's all they need.
I'm not saying that it's going to work, but I think that's what they want. They want the ability to...
Yeah, they do want that, but I think they also want more.
They want the ability to set their own terms. They want ability.
Yes,
want,
that's what I said at the very beginning.
But it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to say, hey, the U.S., we want you to send the EPA here and do this for us. Why couldn't they just set that all up themselves? They can set up their own legal system. They can set up their own judicial system.
They can set up their own environmental protection
agency. Why not?
They can set up their own army.
Why not?
They can set up their own Army Corps of Engineers.
Why not?
Really? Okay.
Why not?
That's what you think.
I think that is
failure in the making.
Why would you
try to just go it alone?
Why would you want something from a government that's already
and grafted and it's, you know,
yes, because you know that's how the Lakota are. They just waste money.
No, any small organization that comes into that much money without a lot of extra expertise and aid.
So what you're thinking?
It doesn't matter whether you're Lakota or Caucasian.
So what you're saying is you're taking a paternalistic attitude.
No,
you are.
I'm saying if you're smart, you will want help.
I'm not saying that they're not going to get help, but what makes you think that they need help from the United States federal government?
Well, why couldn't they, that's one of the best areas of expertise.
Why couldn't they bring
it? Why would you throw away that relationship?
Why could
when you're surrounded by it anyway? You were talking about it being landlocked before. Would make sense to say, we want to strike a deal. We want your army protection. We want your science protection. We want your educational aid, and we want a bunch of money. Not science protection.
If you were disenfranchised people at the first, and you were given the ability to do so, would you immediately pick the people that have been literally in your mind either oppressing you or ignoring you for that length of time?
Why wouldn't
you just pull out some outsiders from Japan or from Europe to do all those for you?
Because what if they're not allowed to fly into my area, first of all? I mean, there's a practical aspect too. But second of all, if I am the disenfranchised people, I am going to want to suck dry as much as I can.
The cash payments come from.
It's not just about cash, though.
You're assuming money
is everything to you. That's all.
Okay, so you're telling me you're going to get all these resources. You're going to get all these.
I'm going to try to get some. Yeah, that benefit me under my terms.
And how do the
access to them?
Yes,
absolutely.
And how does that affect the bottom line of the United States? It's how much money the investment they need to put into it.
It does come down to money. No, it
doesn't
just about money. It's also about expertise. It's about access. Things that don't even have a dollar value. I can get the
Those all have dollar values. What are you talking about?
I could get the same people for the same amount of money, but they're not all equal.
Yeah, you can get better ones.
Sometimes for less.
Maybe you could get a better deal. So that's what I'm saying. Why would you necessarily go to the federal government to pull those resources if you can find a better deal? You can get better help.
I don't disagree that in some cases you will want to go elsewhere. But why wouldn't you want to get the good stuff that you can when it is the best at a cheap price?
Who says it's going to cheap?
Because that's the whole point of saying we want to negotiate a settlement so I can get a freaking bargain out of it.
So why couldn't I take that money and spend it elsewhere to people I think would benefit better? Why not spend it?
Because maybe those aren't the best people.
Well, maybe they are. Maybe they aren't. How would you know until you give it? You're assuming that you know they automatically will have to go to the United States.
No, I'm not. You're making this all up. I'm not assuming that at all. I'm saying in a negotiated settlement, you need cash.
Yes.
Which you agree with.
Yes.
And with that cash, you'll go and buy a bunch of stuff.
Yes.
That you need expertise. And you will also want to negotiate for services from that government and expertise from that government, because you'll be able to get a good deal.
I would say
you got leverage over them that you don't have over the Canadians or the Japanese or the Mexicans.
The only thing you're going to want to really negotiate is travel rights and resource management. Those are the things that you want.
Well, resource management falls right into what I'm talking about.
But that's what I'm saying.
Those aren't the only things, though.
But those are legal issues. Those aren't a service. How are those a service?
Okay, here. I think I may have an example. What if I can say, look, as part of this settlement, you're going to upgrade this airport.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to do it for this amount, which is cheaper than anyone I could get to do it on my own.
Why?
Because you've got an infrastructure to do it. You're already here. You're already in the area. I don't have to pay extra to get it shipped in. And you're going to get.
Why wouldn't I just hire Bechtel to do it for me?
Well, maybe that's how you do it. Maybe,
yeah, and
you know,
Bechtel's
a
private is a
but maybe Bechtel says we won't do it unless the U.S.
You're assuming that too.
Well,
I mean,
but I think that's not.
I mean,
an
you can. You're.
Assumption.
I think you're.
So
just,
you wouldn't try to get anything but cash. You would. That's
no.
What
I'm saying cash and rights to natural resources and travel.
That's it.
As well
that's
as
all you need.
And legal identity. That's status. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't
anything
believe.
Else?
Yeah. That's fine. That's right.
At least I got you to move off of cash and add a few things.
Yeah, but all those aren't services. Those are just legal.
Maybe services is the wrong word, but I think you want to negotiate for more than.
If you want, you can negotiate. I agree with you. If you negotiate for rights, right? Because you want travel rights.
Yeah.
You want border rights.
Yeah.
And you want legal and judicial, legal and political rights.
You probably
for,
want,
but
you
those
probably want
those
defense service too. You probably don't want to have to run your own army. You probably want a defense.
No, you would have a police force.
No.
Costa Rica has a police force. They don't have no army. Why would you?
Almost every one of these situations ends up with the people wanting foreign policy or foreign defense contracts with somebody who has a huge army.
Maybe in this case they don't.
Well, maybe they don't, but do you think that would be smart?
Well, no offense, but if you're in the smack dab in the middle of the United States, why would you need it in the first place?
Well, first of all, maybe you don't want the United States invading. So
that's why you have a border treaty. You would have.
Yeah,
you
right.
Would,
but then there's also the possibility of just getting bombed.
Uh-huh. From?
From anybody.
Yeah, and they would have to overfly the United States, which would be a violation of sovereign territory.
So you don't think they would need any kind of defense?
They would need a police force. That's it.
I disagree with that. I think you still need a foreign defense force. I think you do. I mean, I think you need some sort of foreign policy and some sort of army.
You can have. They can have a limited foreign policy. That's fine. But unless they don't need an army, they need a police force.
You don't think they want defense help from anyone?
Uh-huh.
They just want to have a police force.
Well, where would this imaginary attacking force come from? In any direction, it would fly over the United States, which would already protect.
Or Canada.
Uh-huh. So at that point, I mean, they
what if it's a missile?
It would overfly United States territory.
And what if the United States says, it's headed for Lakota?
At that point,
not our problem.
You know what? You can't tell till it lands. You can tell the general area, but you can't tell till it lands.
So they
would. So at that point, the U.S. say, hey, what if it misses the Lakota
really?
Nation?
So and if somebody is shooting a missile,
Tom,
anywhere close to the United States, we're going to shoot it down.
If it misses, what if the gun system fails? What if the rockets go out?
All
what
right,
if it lands right on Detroit?
I'll buy that. But that's the only, so therefore there's absolute you're absolutely sure that there's no reason that
they will
rely on geography for their protection.
A lot of nations do. Liechtenstein,
Switzerland,
Andorra.
Yeah.
Switzerland actually has its own military, but it's a militia.
But they also rely on their geography for protection.
Yeah.
Lakota aren't up in the mountains.
So
what if the U.S. doesn't care if somebody invades them? What if they allow
it? But see, that's the point, is they would care anyway because it would be going through U.S. sovereign territory.
What if they allow someone to come in and wipe out the Lakota so that the United States can then move in and take the territory?
That would be a very surgical strike, and most likely you would see it coming anyway. And someone would have to open the door, right, to cross into the U.S. territory?
Yeah, the U.S. says, yeah, go in and take them.
Not going to happen.
Why not?
Yeah, you're going to let a foreign army on U.S. soil. No,
mm-hmm.
Not going to happen.
One that you know you can control.
Nope. The only army you can control is the U.S. Army. Sorry.
Not if it's small enough. You said, limit the force to this
bunch
number.
Of ninjas. All right.
It's a bunch of ninjas. All right, this is the longest freaking episode.
I think that was a good argument.
That was a good argument.
I'm hungry.
all right, that's it for this episode. And that's like two episodes of length.
hey, you know what? We have a holiday. That's a bonus.
So if we don't do next one, if we don't do an episode next week.
Nurse on this one.
Yeah, you've got this one. And if we do, it's even extra bonus. So we'll see episode 100, whenever that is.